We've come in our studies in Romans chapter 10 to basically what I've called a new paragraph. Notice the New American Standard here doesn't make the paragraph break for two more verses, and I think that's probably true in the Greek text that's behind this particular version. But I really do think that the questions that he's raising in verses 14 and 15 in some ways are a new idea, not new in the sense that we haven't already seen it, but new in the sense that it doesn't follow exactly on the heels of the prior paragraph. The previous paragraph had to do primarily with the message or the word of the gospel that Paul preached, the word of the faith. And in it, he contrasts initially the righteousness that's based on law to the righteousness that's based on faith. But the vast majority of it is the righteousness that's based on faith and what's all involved in that. And he ended up that paragraph by saying, whoever will call upon the name of the Lord will be saved. And we saw in our study last time that that's a quote out of Joel's prophecy. And it's the same quote that Peter used in Acts 2 in his sermon. And it's rooted in the same issue that's raised here in verse 12, that there's no distinction between Jew and Greek. There's no distinction in relation to Jew and Greek in relation to the issue of righteousness before God. Now, there are all kinds of other distinctions. I mean, even appearance. Jews and Greeks have different facial characteristics, the racial characteristics, the genealogical differences, the cultural differences. There are all kinds of differences. And even in this book, he said, well, then what's the advantage of the Jew? Much in every way, he says. So there are all kinds of differences. But in respect to the offer of righteousness based on faith doesn't know any boundaries in terms of one particular group over another in Jew-Greek issues. And of course, this was a major hot-button issue for the Jews. We've already talked several times about how the Jews got torqued at the point in Paul's defense in Jerusalem, speaking in Hebrew. Everybody was quiet as a mouse, wanting to hear what he had to say because he was speaking in Hebrew. And they listened to him intently until he said that God had commissioned him to go to the Gentiles. And then they wanted to kill him. They said, away with such a fellow. That kind of person doesn't deserve to live. And it was rooted in the fact that they wanted to be recognized and their distinction as God's people, superior to everybody else on the planet, was a pet issue with them, and they were not going to tolerate anybody changing that. And of course, that was the major application change that we've called this, the clarification of God's larger plan. That was the big thing. So on the heels of that, well, I was going to say in Peter's sermon in Acts 2, when he quotes from this same passage in Joel, he actually says that whoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved is a promise made to you and to your children and to all who are afar off. And the afar off terminology is the same terminology that Paul used in Ephesians 2 to tell the Gentiles, just remember you once were afar off. And of course, even in the Joel passage, it says, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. So Paul and Peter were both in the right ballpark when they said, look, there's this major shift that's going to happen in the last days. God's going to do some fantastically good things for everybody, not just Jews. So that was the background, and we really have seen that Paul's extended treatment of the fact that the word of faith consists of both a belief in the heart regarding the issue of the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, and a confession to God by the mouth of the fact that it's Jesus of Nazareth that God has appointed both Lord and Christ. And then from there, he just argued that this, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus of Nazareth is the Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised that Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, you shall be saved. So you shall be saved without distinction in terms of Jew-Gentile differences. In the verses that we're going to look at this evening, we can see that Paul is really arguing for the fact that for anyone to be saved, there has to be somebody that is sent as a herald to make that message known. He says in verse 14, "How shall they call on him?" That's verse 13. "Whoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved. How then shall they call upon him in order to be saved? In whom they have not believed. And how shall they believe in him whom they've not heard? And how shall they hear without a herald? And how shall they herald the message unless they are sent? Just as it's written, 'How beautiful are the feet of those who bring glad tidings of good things.'" This series of questions is doing a couple of significant things, but I want to point out to you something that puzzled me to start with when I was really digging into this. It says that they can't call on him that they haven't heard from. And it says in verse 18, "But I say, surely they have never heard, have they?" Indeed they have. And then he quotes from Psalm 19, "Their voice has gone out into all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world." And Psalm 19 is that psalm that exalts the natural revelation of God in creation, and then goes to specific divine revelation in the Word of God in the next set of verses. It's a presentation of God's revelation to man. It starts with natural creation and goes to special revelation. But in that, he is actually saying that the people have already heard. So what is all this talk about? How they can't call on if they haven't believed, and they can't believe if they haven't heard. They can't hear unless there's somebody sent. Have they not heard? Yeah, they've heard. So that was part of the question I had in my mind. And then he said in verse 19, "Surely Israel didn't know, did they?" At first Moses says, and he quotes a passage that says, yeah, Moses told them this a long time ago. And Isaiah followed up in verse 20. So I want us to think for a little bit before we actually get into the text of the questions of verse 14 and following. And this I just call the larger picture, but it's the context, the larger context of these questions. Paul, when he wrote to the Romans, was writing to the only church in the New Testament that he wrote a letter to that he had no experience with personally as a church. Now, obviously, in chapter 16 of Romans, when he says greet all these people, that he knows a bunch of the people who have moved to Rome and are part of the church there. But in terms of, he didn't plant that church and he didn't teach in that church. And so the book of Romans is a presentation of a letter with no assumptions. Paul is saying, I don't know what you guys know, so let's just start at the beginning. And he starts in chapter 1 with the sinfulness of man, and then he moves to the propitiation in the blood of Christ and the issue of faith, and then, you know, our connection with Adam and the condemnation that came upon us there, and then the sanctification issues that we've studied in chapter 6 through 8, and then this issue of the larger plan. In all of these areas, Paul was in effect giving us our New Testament theology, because he wasn't making any assumptions about what they knew, so he's going to just tell them everything they need to know, at least mentioning it. I think some of the other books of the New Testament are deliberate expansions of some of these truths, like Galatians, where he takes six whole chapters to deal with the issues of justification by grace through faith. But my point in saying all that is that in all of this, Paul, in his ministry of preaching and teaching the gospel, had become fairly well known in the church as a man who was extremely hated by the Jews. Everybody that Paul ever had any interaction with and had written a letter to or whatever were aware that Paul had been Saul of Tarsus, and he was now hated by the Jews, and they were going to persecute him to death if they could. So in his reputation, there was this huge question that the Jews were always pressing, and that is the question of whether Paul was really an apostle. And so that was part of chapters 9 and 10, at the beginning of each one, that Paul was hated for basically two reasons. One of them was that he preached a different message than the law. He preached the gospel of the grace of God in direct and vehement contradiction to the Jewish perversion of the law's basic message. The law's basic message, according to chapter 10, verse 5, was, "He who practices the righteousness which is based on law shall live by that righteousness." In other words, if you're going to be righteous by the law, you're going to have to keep them all. And that is the message, but the Jews had twisted that into some kind of a regulatory process where you didn't really have to keep them all. I mean, the Jews had perverted the whole issue. The law was designed to prove to the Jews that they were sinners so that they would look for salvation from God rather than from their own performance. It didn't work. Over 1,500 years, they developed a deeper and deeper ingrained legalism that caused them to hate God more and more as the centuries went by, to the point that when he came into their midst in the flesh, they couldn't wait to get rid of him. And they violated all kinds of legal precepts in order to have him put to death by Rome on the Passover day. So their own activity proved their hatred. But this issue of Jesus being the manifestation of the grace of God and the theology of the first century being this grace thing was the reason why Paul was hated, because he preached this gospel of grace, and he preached it, secondly, to non-Jews. And they couldn't stand either one of those. They didn't want to be dethroned from their special privileged position as the people of God, and they didn't want their message of, if you want to get along with God, behave, to God will forgive you if you repent. That was what John and Jesus first preached. These two things Paul did in direct harmony with Moses' support, according to verse 19, where Paul says, "Didn't Israel know?" And they said, "Yeah, from the beginning." Paul says, "Yeah, from the beginning." Moses at the first says, "I will make you jealous by that which is not a nation. By a nation without understanding will I anger you." In other words, it's been declared from way back that God is going to do something different, and he's going to actually elevate a people that is not a nation and a nation that is not Jewish and make the Jews angry and jealous. Well, the only way he can make them angry and jealous is if he says what he did back there in chapter 9. "You are not my people, have not become my people." And the converse was true. "You who I called my people are not my people." So this is not an unbiblical concept. It's just one that had been squelched and buried for centuries. So in this larger picture, Paul was hated for his theology and his application of it to Gentiles. But he was insistent upon the validity of his apostleship from the true God of heaven to the Gentiles. He started this book off in chapter 1, verse 5, saying that he had been appointed an apostle by the will of God to the Gentiles. Now, anybody can make a claim like that. But he was aggressive in his proclamation of the message of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, properly understood, Genesis 15:6, righteousness is by faith. Properly understood, he preached the message of the Jewish God, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he preached it to non-Jews. So in order to get people to believe him at the human level, now, we already know that Paul told the Corinthians, nobody can come to the grasp of the gospel and say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. So I'm not discounting the ministry of the Holy Spirit, but I am saying that Paul's argument is that you have to have a somewhat valid basis in content of truth in order to believe something. I mean, the Holy Spirit doesn't just create faith in you in something that you don't even know or understand. There's a process involved in this whole thing, and part of that process is having confidence in the messenger. So, he made the claim that there was a shift in the plan that made him a messenger from God for the Gentiles. And then he argued in chapter 3, which we looked at some last time, that this no distinction thing in verse 12 of chapter 10 is a repeated theme. He said that in chapter 3, starting in verse 22, for there's no distinction between Jew and Gentile, because, verse 23 says, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by His grace. So the whole thing there is there's no distinction. Everybody's a sinner. Anybody that's going to be justified will be justified the same way, because all of them are in the same boat. They're all sinners. So this no distinction thing was established in chapter 3. But he claimed that the Gentiles had a need that the Jews didn't, and that is for a sent messenger. According to chapter 10, verse 18, he point blankly says that they have heard, but he's talking about the Jews. I mean, this Psalm 19 is one of the Psalms of the Jews. And when he says specifically in verse 19, Israel didn't know, did they? And he says, yes, they did. So when he asks a question in verse 14, how shall they call if they haven't believed? How they believe if they haven't heard? How shall they hear without a preacher? How shall they preach unless they've been sent? All of that doesn't really apply to the Jews, because they have had sent messengers all along their entire history, and they have had this proclamation made. Paul was so bold in Romans 4, I believe, as to say that the gospel was preached to Abraham. So the nation of Israel is really not Paul's focus in verse 14-15. He claimed that the Gentiles had this need for a sent messenger that the Jews had already had and rejected. The Jews knew and refused to acknowledge their knowledge. You like that? Acknowledge their knowledge? They knew, but they didn't want to acknowledge it, so they rejected it. The Gentiles did not have those special privileges that belonged to the Jews, so they had a need for someone to tell them of the door of grace that had opened to them. So in this respect, he is actually defending the legitimacy of his preaching to Gentiles, because they had a need the Jews didn't have. Plus, the big argument that the Jews had set forth for Saul of Tarsus becoming Paul and the preacher of this message of grace to non-Jewish people, they argued that he wasn't a true apostle, and that meant that they had to have a valid basis for it, and their basis for it was that he hated them. This man is trying to destroy our religion and tear down the temple and destroy the law. And in chapter 9, he says, that's not true. I'd go to hell for these people. And in chapter 10, he says, my earnest desire and prayer to God for them is that they might be saved. So he's flat out denying in chapters 9 and 10 that their basis for accusation that he's a false apostle based on hate theology is not true. When he turns in verse 14 and 15 to these questions, he's doing it on the basis of verse 12 and 13, where he says, the Jews are not the only ones who get to hear this. The Jews and the Greeks have no distinction in this regard, that the same Lord is Lord of everybody. That was the Jews' big claim. Our God is the true God. He's the God of all creation. He's the God of all humanity. He's the God of everything. Well, then how do you turn around and say he only functions as a God for us? All those other people don't get him to be their God. Well, in that they are alienated from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenants of the promise, that part's true. But the fact of their need is there's no difference between the Jew and the Gentiles in terms of their need. They need this message in order to be saved. And Paul is saying, God sent me to them to give it to them on the basis of verses 14 and 15. In other words, verse 14 and 15 are actually Gentile focused. He's justifying his apostleship to the Gentiles. He's basically asking on the basis of verse 12 that since the same God is Lord of all, then the same Lord of all can be, if he wants to be, rich, abounding in riches for anybody and everybody who wants to call on him. Because there's no distinction. If a Gentile wants to call on the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is free to be abounding in mercy to him. And wasn't that proved in the Old Testament? Who was it that sent a messenger to Nineveh to tell them that they were going to be destroyed and motivate them to turn to God and not be destroyed? Was it some Jew that thought that up? Absolutely not. It was the God of the Jews who said to Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh. And Jonah said, I am not going to Nineveh. And then after he repents and goes to Nineveh, his gleeful proclamation to the Ninevites was, in 40 days you're going to get everything that God owes you for all the wickedness that you've done. 40 days and you're going to be destroyed. And he was glad. And they read the gladness and they heard the declaration. And from the king on down, they humbled themselves in sackcloth and ashes and repented. And so they were spared. And Jonah got mad at God. The whole point here is the Jews have always had a thing against anybody but them being really have the mercy of God open to them. They've never wanted that to be extended to anybody else. And the root of it is their possession of the law that they twisted. Granted, the Ninevites were terrible people, horrible people, but the Jews were as bad or worse because of the high privilege that had been extended to them and the way they distorted it. They had been given the law as a revelation from God, and they knew the primary impact of that revelation was the proper relationship between God and his creature is that the creature will love the God above all others. You'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. There weren't very many Jews in 1,500 years of legal history that did that. And if that's the greatest commandment, then all these Ninevites and all the wicked things they've done doesn't add up to that. That's not the worst you can do. The worst you can do is be a creature and not love him. So, Paul is going to validate or justify his existence as an apostle to the Gentiles with these questions. And the questions are not hard. The first question is, how do you call on somebody that you don't believe? The offer of the gospel is, if you call on the name of the Lord, you'll be saved. But how do you call on the name of the Lord if you don't believe the Lord? If you don't believe in the Lord? If you haven't, well, that's enough on the terms of belief. How do you call if you haven't believed? Well, that's basic Bible 101. The mouth speaks out of the abundance of the heart. It's what you believe in your heart that causes you to use your voice in the ways you use it. So if you don't believe in your heart, you can't call on the name of the Lord. That's why Paul says you have to believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead and confess with your mouth. Well, confessing with your mouth without believing in your heart is a waste of your breath. God isn't fooled by your false confession, and your false confession deceives, well, it might deceive some people who don't know you very well, but doesn't even deceive you. You're calling on somebody you don't even trust. And Paul just basically says that the first part of this call has to be the believing part. But there's a part to the believing that has to be brought into the picture too, and that is, how do they believe in him if they haven't heard from him? How do you believe something without hearing, first of all, what it is you're supposed to believe? It is impossible to have a content-free faith. If you don't believe something because there's nothing there to believe, it's impossible for you to exercise faith in nothing. And if you haven't heard something specific from God, you don't have anything to believe. And if you don't believe it, you can't call. And if you don't call, you can't be saved. So Paul is just working his way backwards. The salvation is dependent on the calling, and the calling is dependent on the believing. And the believing is dependent on having a content to believe, something that you've heard. And by the way, the hearing is not, I don't know what the figure of speech is called, but it's when you use a part of something to reference the whole. If you're deaf, you can still hear. It's a figure of speech. The whole issue is the question of how to call on somebody that you don't believe in, that weds the issue of the fruit to the root. The fruit's the calling, the root's the believing. And if you both believe and call, the outcome is the righteousness of faith. So the fruit, that is confession to God with the mouth, reality in respect to your confidence that Jesus of Nazareth is the Lord, and the root in the belief in the heart that God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead so he is who he said he was, you can trust him because he's been raised from the dead, validated as the Son of God by that. The issue then of, well, I already said that. I'm looking at my notes and getting confused. The impossibility of the fruit without the root. You can't call if you don't believe. If you call without faith, it's just a lie. So that raises the next issue, and that is believing on somebody that you haven't heard from, and the issue of hearing in order to believe is a issue of what I call content-dependent conviction. You have to have something to believe, and when you have that something, you have to have the strength of conviction that it's true before you can put this issue of faith together. And I've been, for months now, maybe years, I've been dealing with this issue of the biblical concept of faith, and it's starting to gel real clearly in my brain. I think that in terms of believing, you have several factors. One of them is the intellectual factor. There has to be content. That's something you get with your head. That's something that somebody tells you or you figure out. But anyway, it's an intellectual reality. You can't believe without some content in your brain, some intellectual content. But intellectual content is not faith. In addition to the intellectual content, you have to have the issue of conviction that it's true. But conviction that something's true, some specific content is true, is not saving faith, because there are people who believe things are true but reject them. So it's not content plus conviction that equals faith. There's another thing. That is content plus conviction plus what we've called commensurate response. This is James's argument that faith without the commensurate response, which he calls works, is dead. It's not productive. It can't produce life. Biblical faith is a composite of at least those three factors. You've got specific content in your mind. You are convinced, however you come to this conviction, the Spirit of God is the one who creates it. But however he does that, you believe this content's true. But it's more than that. You yield to it. You stop resisting it. And the cessation of resistance, well, that's probably the third part of biblical faith, cessation of resistance. And then the fourth part is there's an automatic response, a commensurate response. So biblical faith has those four components instead of the three. Okay? But the point that I'm trying to make here is this believing on somebody without being able to hear is impossible. And that means that this question, how shall they believe on him whom they have not heard, is insisting that the content has to have been delivered to them in an intellectually capable way, so that the person actually gets the thoughts in their mind that is the content of the thing to be believed. However that happens, whether it's written word, whether it's something they hear with their ears, or something that they see sign because they don't have audio ability, or maybe some kind of rational reasoning process like these apologetic guys produce, you know, evidences that this is truth, the apologetics part of it. C.S. Lewis apparently came to know Christ through an evaluation of these reasoning things. And so there is, however it happens, and not everybody's a C.S. Lewis. Not everybody thinks their way through anything. There are an awful lot of us who came to know Christ because somebody told us the gospel. We believed it, however that happened, without a whole lot of other stuff. But there was content, there was conviction, there was a cessation of resistance, and there was then a commensurate response to it. So this question is a question of the necessary requirement for content to be delivered. How shall they hear if there isn't any proclaimer, no herald? And so there is a requirement for the content to be delivered by a legitimate herald. And here's Paul's whole, this is where he's been going. The question of how, if there's no distinction between Jew and Greek, if the same God is willing to be merciful to Jews and Greeks, then for the Greeks to have this promise delivered to them that if they'll call on the name of the Lord, they'll be saved, somebody's got to tell them that. Somehow they've got to be, that's got to be delivered. And biblically, I wrote a page that's in my website, or Kelly's, that he does for me, where I raised the question of why God doesn't just talk to each one of us individually and just tell us all the things we need to know individually. And one of the things that I observed from history is that among the followers of Islam in our generation, there are many who are turning to Jesus as the Christ, and their initial beginning point is often some kind of a dream or a vision. And in the dream or the vision, they are urged to turn their attention to Jesus the Christ. They're not given the gospel. The dream or the vision doesn't outline the gospel. It just turns their attention to Jesus. So that by doing that, they come into contact with some gospel deliverers. People who are willing to tell them about this Jesus. Perhaps they buy a Bible. Whatever. However it works. The interesting thing about them is that they almost never claim that their dream or vision explained the gospel to them. It just pointed them in the right direction. That's just part of God's way. Paul is going to argue, basically right here, that somebody's got to be the messenger. Now, there is a prophecy in the book of the Revelation that says, before Jesus comes back, because he said in Matthew 24 that this gospel must be preached unto all the nations before the end. That was a requirement. The gospel has to be preached in the whole world before Jesus returns the second time. And in Revelation it tells us that there is an angel who flies through the midst of heaven declaring the everlasting gospel. Now how that's going to play out in fulfillment, I have no clue. I don't know how literal to take those words. But I do know that the outcome of those words, however literally or illiterally or whatever you call them, end up with everybody understanding what the gospel's claims are. And in addition to that, the book of Revelation tells us about two witnesses that are going to be declaring the gospel and 144,000 Jewish people, 12,000 from each tribe that are going to be out there proclaiming the gospel. And then everybody who is saved by the hearing of the gospel is going to be telling their friends and neighbors. And some of them are going to be getting their heads cut off because they told the wrong neighbor or the wrong member of their family or whatever in terms of the antagonism. But the point is, you got to have this herald. Somebody's got to preach it. Somebody's got to herald it. And in regard to the heralding, he says, how shall they hear without a herald? And how shall they herald it unless somebody sends them? And the word for sent there is the typical Hebrew or Greek word for sent, apostello. But it's the root verb for apostle. So Paul is basically arguing in verse 15 that the herald that is sent is going to originally be with apostolic authority. In other words, the message will be guaranteed to be accurate. Now, I know that there are a lot of missionary organizations that use these verses to try to get people to commit to taking the gospel to somewhere in the world besides where they're living. And I have no problem with that. But there aren't any verifications of the theological accuracy of those missionaries. They're not apostles in the ultimate sense. authoritative representatives of the truth about God. They're simply people who have been given the gospel, they believed it, and now they're going to go tell somebody else. And probably if they're going out with the purpose of preaching to the lost, they may even have the gift of evangelism. And if they do, they'll be seeing fruit from their labors. The point, however, is that the question of whether a person can be saved by calling on the name of the Lord without somebody who has been sent by God to tell them, he's basically saying it's not possible, so you guys are going to have to make room for me in this issue of me being the herald to the Gentiles. This is God's plan. So, the one who created the content of the gospel is also the one who sent the apostle to the Gentiles. Saul of Tarsus. Paul. And then he justifies his whole entire set of questions in verse 15 with a quote. It's out of Isaiah 52:7. The quote is this, for the Jews, in Isaiah 52, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring glad tidings of good things. What he's saying is how terrific it is, how wonderful these people are who bring us this news. And he said that was true in Isaiah's day, and it's true today. In other words, this whole issue of being able to recognize the beauty of the feet of the one who brings the good news is rooted in the fact that salvation can only occur if somebody walks the truth into your experience. Can't happen otherwise. So Paul is in a very real sense actually saying, look, you guys have opposed my apostleship to these people who need to be saved. You don't even want to be saved, and you oppose my preaching of the gospel of salvation by grace. But you really don't want these Gentiles to see it, and that just proves that you don't like the content, and therefore the feet of those who bring the good news to you stink. They're not beautiful to you, but anybody who profits from the gospel of the grace of God and comes to call on the name of the Lord through it recognizes the tremendous benefit of having somebody walk that message into their experience. So, the messengers should be treated as a very positive factor rather than opposed and hated as an enemy. I think that's Paul's point here. I think in light of the larger plan of God, since his larger plan consisted of taking the message of the good news beyond the borders of Israel and making that message a grace-based reality, since that is the larger plan, then we shouldn't oppose this man who is appointed by God as an apostle to the Gentiles. In a way, he's kind of saying what he said at the end of the book of Galatians. I don't want to hear it anymore from all you opposers. I bear in my body the wounds of being faithful to this message. You can oppose me, you can beat me, you can even kill me. But it won't change the fact that I'm preaching a legitimate, true message from the only true God, whom the Jews claim they believed in, but didn't. So that's my understanding of these questions. The questions are not primarily applicable to Israel, which is he's going to get into that in the very next verse. But it is a validation or another repeated declaration of the necessity for his ministry to the Gentiles. If God really has opened the door of grace to the Gentiles, then you ought to be looking for people carrying the message to them. You ought to be looking for it, because that's part of God's plan.